So by way of introduction, I'm Jen Price, Jennifer Price. I work at Calvert Foundation. We're located in Bethesda, Maryland. How many people have heard of Calvert Foundation? Okay, cool. I've been there 5 years. I manage all our strategic initiatives, but came over to manage our U.S. investment portfolio. So I come from a finance background and a community development background, so they've come to a great place in my life. And what we are, we're a 17-year-old nonprofit financial services organization, and we have a flagship product called the Calvert Foundation Community Investment Note. And what it is a fixed income product or an investment product that people can buy for as low as $20. While that money is with us, we invest in organizations around the globe in the form of loans. And we have about $400 million under management right now. We also have a wholly owned subsidiary, CIP, Community Investment Partners, that does asset and fund management. And that is a fee-for-service business. But what they're trying to do is capture institutional dollars, namely banks, perhaps even accredited investors, and encourage them to think about how they can make their assets work with impact as well. And so our overall vision at Calvert Foundation is to make every investor an impact investor. It's an audacious goal, but we really believe that if everyone just had 1 or 2% of their portfolio invested with impact, that's a lot of money that can unlock and a lot of magic that can happen in this world. So that's what I do.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm Melanie Audette. I'm with Mission Investors Exchange. And I wanted to start by asking you a question. How many in the audience are from private foundations? So family foundations, private foundations. Okay, thank you. I started my career at a family foundation in Seattle, and it's so wonderful to be here with you and to feel the passion and the energy at this conference. And I'm excited to introduce to you, hopefully since this is 101, some new ideas for the impact that you can make with your foundation. And I wanted to tell you a little bit about the work that we're doing with over 250 foundations from around the country who are members of our association. We help just in the way that the Council on Foundations helps foundations, but in this very specific area of mission investing. So we do educational trainings, and we help mission investors to come together in convenings and with webinars, and we work very closely with the council. We have an agreement with them, so just as of this year. So we have actually 7 opportunities at this conference for folks to learn about mission investing. So we're really excited about that partnership and excited to have you all here today. And we'll be asking you a few more questions about your work and your interest in mission investing. And we'll define mission investing for you, just in case you truly are 101 or 101 minus, which I was when I started this work just a little while ago.
So opening it up, how many people have done an impact investment, an MRI or a PRI, however you define it? Just raise your hand if you have. Okay, so there's a few people that are comfortable. How many people in the room are skeptics? You know, kind of you're in here with like a big question mark over your head if you should flee for the door or not.
Board members were skeptics.
Okay, only one. Go get him.
And he's a friend.
Yeah, just take him out. Two.
Well, no, okay. I'm skeptical about our passive.
That's great. Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Clients are skeptical.
Okay. So we have our clients are skeptical, capacity to execute, skepticism. Any other comments along those lines? That's helpful context. So great. And taking another question for the audience, what do you hope to get out of this session? Doesn't have to be lawn or antiquated. You can just popcorn it out so we make sure we get there. Yeah.
Two things. One is to deal with client skepticism when I'm not an expert in the financial services industry.
Right.
And the other is to learn a little bit about it so I can be a better advocate.
Okay. So to learn about it, to be a better advocate, and how to ease client skepticism being, you know, part of a conversation that maybe you're not feeling confident in the finance piece of this conversation. Yes. Yes, please.
And the biggest thing for me is helping board members understand it so they don't see it as a huge risk.
Great.
Better ability to communicate it.
Does that resonate with a lot of people? Okay.
So that's one of the biggest barriers, actually. That is, there's research being done on that right now by our partners at Harvard University. So we'll be able to share more information with you about working with trustees and sharing that information.
Okay. Okay, great. Any other thoughts? Yes, up front.
I'm interested in looking at, or considering listening to your presentations, how we can better tap the public dollars that are being invested in economic development and all of that to address mission-related investment goals. So how the public dollars can help you achieve your goals.
Okay, so how we can tap the public dollars to better achieve our goals.
Or direct the public dollars.
Direct the public dollars, yes.
Two other things I guess I would say. Any case studies about people who've been successful doing this? And then the other thing would be, any history or any kind of examples you have of it being vetted through the tax process and it's been blessed.
Okay, so examples, and actually we do have some that we're going to hand out as part of our group activity in small groups, so you'll get some on paper, and we'll share some, and then tax. We might not get to the tax, but I can direct you to where to go. There has been a lot written on that. Okay, we were just opening up for you that just joined. We only introduced ourselves and just went around what people's wants to get out of the session were. Yes.
What are the due diligence? How do you evaluate all the various options? Is there any kind of screening
Okay, so screening due diligence, which we might touch on today, will get very much covered in 201. Where we hope to leave you today is with a common foundation, a feeling of understanding the definitions, the vocabulary, the range of vocabulary, might I underscore. I would say even people that are practitioners in this space, we debate definitions and jargon all the time with no real outcome of unison yet, but we're getting closer. So, we'll get the definitions on the table that should give you comfort and feeling in control. And then we'll leave you at the place where 201 is going to be really engagement and dialogue with people who have been doing it. Family foundations who have been executing at MRIs and PRIs. I call it impact investing in a general sense, so I'm going to stick with that term going forward. And tell you of some of the due diligence they've gone through, some of the challenges they've faced. Okay, so we're going to begin. My first place and launching point is to connect to the plenary today about systems. And so the first 10 minutes, I'm just going to convince is a strong word, but encourage you not to give up on learning about impact investing and pushing through some of the barriers I heard, your board getting them on board, your clients getting them on board, the IRS getting them comfortable if they might need to get comfortable through you about this work you're doing. There is, I believe impact investing is here to stay. That is, this part of a systems change, that it is worth the investment to learn this and to incorporate it into your work as it is appropriate. So that's the first piece I want to travel through. And I want to connect it to what we heard today about systems thinking. And eerily enough, I pulled this definition off of Wikipedia that seemed very similar to the one at the plenary. So that gave me great comfort. Because to me, when I first saw systems thinking, not having dove in deep in it myself personally, it was a little bit, it was a little cloudy, a little gray what that really meant. So I needed to go online and really wrap my brain around it. This simple definition helped me. Systems thinking has been defined as an approach to problem solving by viewing problems as parts of an overall system rather than reacting to a specific part. Outcomes or events and potentially contributing to further development of unintended consequences. And for me, what really came out here was problem solving. That's what we do every day with our foundations. We might have different problems that we're passionate about. It could be as broad as ending poverty and as aspirational as ending poverty. It could be as focused and specific as cutting obesity or declining obesity in youth in San Jose. But there's a problem that we're all out to address, and that's a unifying part of the conversation we have here. The first two words, systems thinking too, really got me excited because I think this begs us, this gives us an opportunity to lift out of our daily work, out of the trees, and look into the forest. And remember what forest we're in and what possibilities exist. And then perhaps go back down into our silo with a better understanding of what's surrounding us. It is tough in the day-to-day work of you got things to do, you have goals to meet or impacts to achieve or a board to respond to get out of the kind of very focused next task. You know, system thinking begs us to go up high. And that's a real, you know, kind of really fun thing to be able to let yourself do. It's a luxury. And so with that in mind, when we think about going up into the trees, about the macroeconomic trends we're living in today, it very much supports the emergence of impact investing, I believe. All these will look familiar to you. These are the trends that are sweeping through our society. Globalization, the shifting demographics, particularly here in the US, particularly in different regions of the US. Innovation, that being a really honored cultural icon. Entrepreneurship, the emergence of the social entrepreneur. Business schools now are just littered with courses around social entrepreneurship, you know, impact investing. When we were there, some of us, you know, even maybe 10 years ago, those courses didn't exist. This is a honored type of skill, innovation. Climate change, you know, increasingly among conversation. Technology, this really allows businesses to start up really nimbly, right? The idea that you have to build up a lot of cash and buy inventory, those old rules might not apply anymore. Technology has done a lot for the entrepreneur and for our culture to connect. And this last bullet is a big one. Decrease in private resources and government funding. And this is where the opportunity for impact investing really comes to rise. You know, we all can debate about this bullet and how severe we think it's going to be. But it is part of our macroeconomic trend, I think we can probably all agree. And we look at the resources that then are available to invest in our communities where the government might leave off. A complementary, an additive resource is to engage more people in impact investing, which is simply bringing private dollars into social problems. And those dollars are hopefully creating an economic and a social and financial return. So with these macroeconomic trends coming up from the top, what's coming down, like, you know, how are the grassroots coming up and responding to this? Here we go. These are some of the big things I've seen in the landscape of noticing these big trends circling up above what's coming down in the grassroots. And again, why I think impact investing is here to stay. The profile of young professionals entering the work world really reflect a commitment to business as a means for creating social, environmental, and economic change. They polled the millennials, Generation Y, and 71% of them said a goal for them in their career, their professional career, was to have a job that connected social good with their business. 36% of our workforce by 2014 will be Gen Y. In 2020, it's going to be 46%. So that goal of theirs is going to become part of our workforce in force. Many business leaders are embracing a wider view of the firm, which has invited new corporate forms that link both profit and purpose. And this, you know, has come out of the great crash, the financial crash. And you have entrepreneurs now that want a business model that's more sustainable, that isn't so reliant on donations, that maybe has an earned income stream, so it's more self-sustaining. And as a result, there's different types of corporate forms that are emerging. There's a hybrid, where there's your traditional nonprofit, perhaps, that started a social enterprise that is a for-profit, earning income that's going back to subsidize the nonprofit, or perhaps the B Corp is another example here. And I can talk more about that entity or structure for anyone that would like to know more. But it is on the rise. I believe there's about 12 states now where the B Corp is registered and 14 in the queue to get that built into their system. Infrastructure to support the measurement of social environment impact continues to develop and mature. This is all the creation of infrastructure groups to measure social and environmental impact. There's GEARS, there's GIN, there's PULSE. These might sound like jargon to you, and it is for the most part, but it won't be someday if you continue down this path learning about impact investing. What these groups do is they try to capture that social return. Just like you can capture financial return through returns on your investment, these groups are trying to capture the social element. Very, very important for this piece of our industry to mature impact investing. Next, philanthropy can deploy a range of tools in support of this shift, including research, program-related investments, mission-related investing, and awards. And you know, philanthropy has been on the leading edge of a lot in our culture. And here it is again happening. There are many philanthropists who are already investing with impact. They're finding a way to align their endowment or their program dollars with their mission. And they're out there, and it's great to find them, connect with them, ask them how they're doing it, and where the challenges were to learn from them. Always better to learn from other people's mistakes, I found. But that's happening. And you know, this final point is it's all happening very quickly. That this impact investing, this some people call it capitalism 2.0 in a very dramatic sense, this new way of doing business, this new way of investing in organization, a new way of directing your capital, it's happening very quickly. And where we are now is there's parts of it that are very organized, and I would argue we're in the moment of going to scale. How we're going to get there still leaves a lot of questions, but that's probably when I look out 5 or 10 years being a practitioner in this field, that's where we're going. We got the fundamentals. Now we're going to scale. So I hope in these first few slides what I did was connect impact investing to a larger systems change for you so you could feel the gravity here of why it's great to learn what's going on. It might not apply to you in the next year or 2 years, but my guess is it will in the next 5 or 10. And so taking that landscaping, I'm going to pass it over to Mel, who's now going to talk more about definitions, some of the real nuts and bolts, so we can all have the same foundation to work on for when we go to our case study, and then talking to our small groups a little bit, you know, blue sky. If you could incorporate impact investing into your work or into your foundation, what opportunities could that unlock? And also, what challenges do you see occurring? So, Mel, I'll pass it to you.
All right.
Do you want the cord or the clicker?
Actually, I'll take the
clicker. Okay.
Perfect. Yep. Thanks. So, how does all this apply to you and your foundation? Let's talk about that next. We have the big, big picture. Have we gotten to the why? That's what I want to make sure. And then we'll talk about some specifics around how this work can be a part of what you do. Before we asked how many people were doing some kind of PRI, program-related investment, or mission investing, and we got a few responses around the room, I want to ask another somewhat related question now, and that is, how many of you have made a loan to one of your nonprofits? Did you raise your hand when we asked about mission investing? Okay, loans are probably about 80% of what people know as program-related investments. In kind of the history of this work, loans have been a very popular form of mission investing. So we'll talk a little bit about that. But this is the amount of money that was granted in 2012 by US foundations. Almost $47 billion. Sounds like a lot of resources in order to fix the problems or look for opportunities in your work. When you think about your own foundation, do you feel like you have enough to be able to live up to the aspirations that you have? Who thinks that they have quite enough money to do everything they want to do? Raise your hand. Okay. Well, this is where that blending of your support to organizations and to your communities can help to increase the impact of what you're doing. So this is like giving a boost to your grant making, a boost to the communities that you're trying to serve. So why mission investing? Well, we just said the needs outweigh the capacity. We don't have enough to make that systems change that needs to happen in your communities. We just don't have it. As far as your endowment, which as all of you know who have private foundations, you pay out, you have to pay out 5%, your payout number. That other 95% represents significant value in communities and in the structure, the capital structure as a whole. And when we talk about program-related investments, oftentimes they're made out of that 5% or go into the endowment. But the other 95% can go to work for you as well. And so we'll talk a little bit about market rate investments. I'll explain more later. These type of investments have the potential of leveraging more dollars to your cause. So just to give you one example of that, if you have a project that you're working on with a grantee, and you are open to taking the risk to becoming a lender to that organization in a subordinated position, so when the loan comes due, you would not be the first one to be paid. If you're guaranteeing a loan, that means that the nonprofit you're working with might be able to get money that they wouldn't be able to get otherwise, and or they may be able to get a lower interest rate, thus saving money. One example of leverage. In the case of PRIs, typically they're significantly larger than a grant that your foundation would make, but they also typically take longer to process through because of the due diligence and the steps that you need to take. Once you make a PRI, which again I'll explain as we go through, those dollars stay out in the community, and it's a way of keeping dollars out and recycling through. So it's if you look at the spectrum of risk with grants on one side, you know you won't be repaid a grant. That's, you grant the money for good purpose and that's it. This recycling, when it's the appropriate case, and oftentimes alongside a grant, that money will come back to you. You cannot keep it within your foundation at that point. The dollars, once they're granted, need to stay out in the community. So if we look at total assets of U.S. foundations, instead of about $46 billion or $47 billion, it's at least $646 billion, which is a figure that can make a much greater difference. So Jen mentioned that she uses the term impact investing and not mission investing, and this terminology is one of those barriers to acceptance because it's alphabet soup as far as the financial terms and the PRIs and the MRIs, I'd like to shed a little bit of light on those for you today. But impact investing is typically, in our book, we deal mostly with foundations, is typically the broader sphere of investors who can take part in this work. Beyond foundations, institutional investors and pension funds, for instance, but we're coming to terms with this impact investing really representing the entire field. PRI just means program-related investment that we'll go into, and MRI is market rate mission-related investment. We already talked about the 5% and the 95%. In a traditional foundation, there are grants which receive programmatic or social returns or environmental returns, and traditional investments, which are those financial returns. In this model of mission or impact investing, there's a merger of sorts, so that if you have people who deal with finance in your organization and people who deal with program or grant making in your organization, in the case of doing mission investments, there needs to be conversations around the work. We found that when we talk about failure also in our work, we want to learn from mistakes. And we found that when there have been failures, it's typically because the program side isn't talking to the finance side, or vice versa. And so this is a change, a systems change within organizations, where many of the large foundations really just carve out people from both sides and start a PRI team, and they're working on these investments together. But the way we hope that things go in foundations is that these investments are seen by program officers in particular as just one additional tool to use beyond grants. And so having more knowledge and education for program officers and foundation trustees will help that work. Here's one of the continuums with the traditional and endowment investments on one side, with primary motivation as financial return. Primary motivation for grants is social return. We're blending this in the middle, and you'll hear the term blended value as well. And all that means is that you're looking through this investment for both in the market rate investment for a social return or environmental return, along with a financial return that's called blended value. Okay. So let's talk about program-related investments first. The IRS has regulated PRIs for foundations, and this is not new. PRIs, this has been going on technically, as far as the IRS is concerned, since 1969. Started out with work by the Ford Foundation. But for all practical purposes, Ben Franklin left money in his will to start a revolving loan fund for artisans. So we like to think of Ben Franklin as one of the first mission investors with that fund. The IRS says that you have to do three things, and they give examples, lots of examples, and there are new examples that are that the IRS has put out there too. So all in all, you have about 20 examples that you can draw upon for your work, and your attorneys can draw upon too. And those three things are that they're made to further your foundation's charitable purpose. A PRI must go for that social return first. Not the financial return, the social return. Lacks significant investment purpose in this case. What that means is that a traditional investor would not go into a PRI under those terms. So you are giving, they're concessionary terms, you're giving something up to do a PRI. You're not going for a market rate return. It needs to be under market rate. So if the if market rate is 6%, and you go 5%, and you fit all the other requirements, then that's a PRI. A lot of foundations will do 0% loans, 1% loans. It's all a matter of what you choose to do. And of course, the good old IRS likes to make sure that we're not using any advantages that we get for electioneering or lobbying government officials. So those are the three things. As I said, the PRIs may be counted against your 5% payout. The interest or any income that comes back in from these vehicles can go back into your corpus, but if you accept the loan repayment, for instance, back into your foundation, then you'll be taxed on it. So how foundations deal with that typically is with revolving loan funds. If a PRI fails, it's converted to a grant in that case. I mean, that's if you would consider it a grant. The interest that would come back would be added to your corpus.
You said it would be, so when it comes back in, if it's, it can be done in stock or it can be done in payment. Any case when it comes back as income, it's taxable.
So for a PRI, it has to. A PRI has to stay out that base amount. Anything that you earn on top of it can come back in.
Well, but with the base amount, if you get that repaid, that's not taxable.
Right.
Okay.
No, the base amount is taxable. the income would not be taxable. So in other words, once you make a PRI, and this is different from a market rate investment, it's a below market rate investment in the case of a PRI. Any income you're fine with, but that base amount needs to stay out. And so you would reinvest it somewhere else, and you would not be taxed on it in that case. And it is tricky, and it's something that you need to remember for PRIs. Does that make sense for everyone?
I'm confused on how it's different from a grant. It sounds like you still have some control over it once you've paid it out.
You would negotiate terms with whomever you're. Do you mind if I use loans as an example, because that's the most typical? Okay. So you would negotiate, say, a promissory note with your grantee for a particular rate. It could be zero. It could be anything under market rate.
Okay, so it's zero. Just
right.
So we don't have to
right. You need to choose a grantee who has the capacity to repay you. So there needs to be an income source within your grantee. So let me give you an example. There is an art center being built who has gotten federal funding and promises from their capital campaign, and they would like to go forward with construction, but they can't because they haven't gotten the funds in that have been promised to them. They may come to you and say, could you give me a bridge loan until those funds come in? That would be an example of where you negotiate terms with that organization. You loan them the money, you prepare the documents, you do the due diligence you want to have an established relationship or outside counsel to do the due diligence, or you have that capacity within your foundation. When they receive the funding from the sources that they've established, they would pay you back. So there's an income stream that's going to be coming back to you in your foundation.
But it doesn't actually come back in?
Technically it does, but it has to be paid back out in something else for a PRI, into something else for a PRI.
So once you buy into that kind of program, you're committed to finding people who qualify in some way.
That's right.
For a loan. So
you're
in a committed situation. Mm-hmm.
If you count it towards your payout, yes.
Could you turn it into a grant? Sorry.
Yes.
I don't know if that's what you're alluding to. But you can just say, let's say.
Yes, you can turn it into a grant.
And you say, okay, we've already paid it out, so here's $100,000.
Yes, you could do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so
no problem.
In a revolving loan relationship.
Right. That's your choice.
With the same person, but it sounds like you have to keep that money out.
It could be with the same organization.
But you could just give it as well. You don't have to keep loaning it.
You could do that. Yep.
And so let's say, so you gave this loan, and it was $1 million. And now it comes back 5 years later, they pay it back, they get all their funding, they pay it back to you. And let's say your 5% is $1 million. You basically have to give away $1 million that next 5 years later. If that amount becomes back, and if you give it back out, is that on top of your normal 5% you have to give out? So it's
yes.
Mm-hmm. Plus whatever you got back. Okay. If you count it as a grant,
right. No, you need to pay out your 5%. You need to pay out your 5% every year. I may have lost you a little bit on that. I want to make sure that I'm giving you the right information. So if the loan comes back to you and you don't pay it back, then you will be taxed on it. If you keep it out, then you will not be taxed on it. And it's considered the 5% from the year that you gave. Okay, let's move on. For the people who said that they had made mission investments, what type of investment did you make?
For Marcia's point, it would be actually a loan to a third party, which was actually for small businesses, which you can do through this. And usually you call community development financial institutions, mm-hmm. or there's also a government entity in our state that acts very similar to that. Which allowed us to get into more of the small businesses that we wanted to help support. And in the way it is, it's actually a loan for 5 years, no, 6 years. and for $50,000. It was a small test we were trying there. So $50,000, and it matched against other dollars that this group also had. Mm-hmm. So it helps minimize their risk and minimize it and help minimize our risk too, of course. And what will happen is, in 6 years, that will come back to us, and we'll spit it out again in the form of a grant that is on top of our, so let's say I have to give out $700,000. I now give out some $150,000 in that year. So it skips the, get taxed. I'm just spitting it out again. And the thing is, if you are revolving, for every year that money comes in, you have to spit out the X amount that came back. Mm-hmm. So let's say it's a 5-year loan and it's coming back to you. So this year you get, say, $20,000 back. You just spit out that $20,000, and you just keep revolving it. It could be in the form of a loan again, or it could be in the form of a grant.
Right.
It's up to you. It's totally up to you. And the loan we have is at 0% interest.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, it becomes trust. It's a matter of trust because when you think of most loans, you actually have collateral and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And these, it's more trust than collateral in what you're dealing with. So,
right, on the PRI side. That does help. That does help. Thank you. There are other ways to do this work where there's no payout. So, for instance, we consider that loan guarantee as a mission investment. And that unless the organization you were guaranteeing the loan for defaulted, there's no payout in that case. We also consider cash deposits to be a part of this work. And what that means is looking at community banks, for instance, in order to house some of your cash at a community bank so it's being reinvested into that community. There's no payout in that case. But it's a way of taking some of your assets and align, if your mission is poverty in urban areas, for instance, that's a way of aligning your assets with the mission of your organization. This covers the whole spectrum of bonds. You may have heard of social impact bonds, which are more pay for performance contracts in partnership with government organizations in that case. There is an example of a large foundation who had a very trusted grantee who was trying to scale up nationally with facilities who guaranteed loans for that organization with no payout that saved millions of dollars for the organization because the nonprofit got lower interest rates because of the heft of the very large foundation allowed them to have that freedom and flexibility with the banks that were loaning money. Mission-related investments on the other side are the area that it's financial first. And it's a way of looking at where your assets lie, and first of all, making sure that they don't run counter to your mission. Looking at your portfolio and making sure that if your mission is to preserve the environment, that you're not investing in companies that are doing detrimental things to the environment. It's the simplest way, but along the line are many exciting opportunities. Looking at venture capital and startups. Some foundations are going into partnership with venture capitalists. And so those lines really are blurring in this financial sphere. For these are typically carved out of the endowment. So looking at it somewhat as another asset class, so that it's identifiable in the first place as this is your pocket of mission investing. But for some foundations, like the F.B. Heron Foundation, which is held up as probably the first one who said, are we an investment company that just gives away a little bit of our money for charity? Or should we go all in and say everything that we do, the investments that we make, should all be aligned towards our mission. And that's the goal of the F.B. Heron Foundation. And we're hearing of other foundations as well who are looking at their work in that way. In this case, those prudent investor standards must be met. And so when you think about the sphere of things, there's $23 trillion under management, which would take a bigger chunk out of some of those problems that we're all trying to fix. And just to help you with the sphere, who supports this type of work? What do we need in order to do this type of work? In these systems, we're doing education as one of the multiple affinity groups or associations. There are others besides us. The GIN is one. I have pulled up on my computer in the back the websites to all of these organizations if you want to take some time later and look. Confluence is another that helps individuals of wealth primarily and also foundations. They're also doing great work. Legal and consulting services, all of those financial documents, the due diligence, the contracts, the attorneys play a big role in that, of course. There are academic and research organizations who are helping to report on the data. We have a challenge in collecting this type of data. The reason I asked about loans is people are doing below market loans and not realizing that there are PRIs. On your tax return, there is a spot to report PRIs, and we encourage you to do that reporting because the data is not necessarily indicative of the amount of work that's being done. And so our organization is collecting that data in order to inform the field. So we're encouraging foundations to please report what you're doing. Financial advisors are such a very important part of this role, of this work, and you will have instances where you may be excited. You'll go home from a conference excited about doing this work. You talk with your trustees. They bring in the financial advisors who may not have been exposed to the work, and they're like, no. And so we have a big challenge to help to inform and educate financial advisors, as well as establish the standards around this work in order to create the monitoring and due diligence for some of those investments that you're making. And CARS is a rating service for those CDFIs, or community development finance institutions, that help you to determine which one you might want to go through as an intermediary organization, and then also monitor the performance of what they're doing. And the deals clearinghouses or places to find investments are extremely important, in addition to the education for nonprofits. Because you, again, may be very excited about the work, but if you can't find an investment to make, you may just not do it at all. So we need to create the demand and create avenues for you finding out about the demand for the investments. A good place to go is your current grantees. Sit down with them and say, "What kind, have you ever asked, what sort of interest rates are you paying?" And look to your friends and peers and colleagues first, to your trusted advisors first. And then you, by talking and learning from each other, you want to talk to the gentleman after the session about what he's done. That's how you can think about it in relation to your own work. There's a 201 session tomorrow morning at 10:30 in the Crystal Room. There's a dine around. I think it may be full, but if there's enough substantial interest, I think that we might be able to maybe cause another table. We'll have to work with Kim Roque from the council on that one. And then there's a 301 session on Monday at 3:30 in the Gold Room. And of course, there are trainings and publications through our organization and others that I encourage you. There are free webinars on our website that you can just go and learn about social impact bonds at the comfort of your desk. We have some events coming up. There's, I'll leave this for you to look on our website for this information. But that's what I have for
now. Okay. So we were hoping that that would give good grounding on definition, so we would have some of maybe the early questions covered, just about what it is and how it looks and how it feels. Is there any lingering questions we can also answer them as we go through the kind of next small group activity, but anything that just is burning on the mind? Yes. So it was your slide. If I can go and answer it, but if you wanted to give it a crack, the question is, there was a continuum you showed that had grants, PRIs, MRIs, and then more traditional investments. And then in between the PRI and MRIs are the recoverable grants. If you're going to grant a PRI at the end, what is the difference between a PRI and recoverable grant?
It's the intention, it's your intention going in. Are you, and this is important because it's about your relationship with the, say with the nonprofit that you're funding. A PRI is expected to be repaid, and that should be clear up front. If it's a recoverable grant, wherein they're successful at whatever it is they're doing, and if they're successful, then they'll pay you back. That's different from a PRI. It's about that agreement up front. And that agreement up front and identifying the intention of the investment being a PRI is extremely important for IRS purposes, especially in relation to an MRI. Because, for instance, the Kellogg Foundation talked with us about the story of their first PRI, which was a below market rate investment. It was an equity investment in an educational software company. It was a below market rate investment identified that way. Well, what happened on the other side was that they made a boatload of money off it when the company went public. So they had, it's very important to clarify at the beginning of the investment that it's a PRI.
Anything else? Yes.
I'm just curious from an example to remind me of a question. So they made a boatload of money. They defined it as a PRI. They made a boatload of money in a capital return, not interest, if I'm understanding you correctly. So what happened with that capital return? Could they add that back to their corpus, or did they recycle that into more PRIs? Or?
They would have to recycle that. I don't know specifically, though I can find out exactly what they did with it. But in this scenario, because it was a PRI or below market rate value, that money had to stay out in some form, and it could be granted out, but it would have to stay out.
The entire return had to be.
What would it have been? That could come back in to the foundation. Yes.
And for that reason, it should be attractive to the financial investment team of the foundation because, you know, if you're furthering your mission, plus you have an opportunity to potentially grow the corpus, they would be very happy, I would think, right?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think some of the challenge in getting them happy and interested is ease of access. So how do you kind of do your first one? Do you kind of find a group you like and just, you know, hey, you want a loan? You know, that's a little bit of a change in relationship with you and that group, right? Instead of being a grantor, you're now in a lender-borrower relationship, very different dynamics. How do you document it? How do you do the due diligence? Making that first one, it's kind of a jumping into the deep end. And how a lot of people have gotten around it, although it's not prescriptive, but what we've seen being very helpful is to use intermediaries as a first stepping off point. There are intermediaries that make these investments as part of their day-to-day activities. That's what they do. That's what Calvert Foundation does. So we take people's investment dollars and put them out to CDFIs, community development financial institution, affordable housing developers, social entrepreneurs, microfinance institutions abroad. Because we're doing it very broadly and we have a certain risk tolerance that we're telling our investors that they're taking, our return on impact might not be as tightly aligned
as your want as a individual family foundation. And that's where you might just have to give a little on the beginning step in working with the intermediary, is you might just have to say, okay, investing with an affordable housing developer that's doing development of affordable housing for older citizens in New England area, that's close enough to my mission to take that first step to program-related or mission investing or impact investing. We worked with a group that actually did this, AARP. This is how they got comfortable with it, is they did an initial note. They bought a Calvert Foundation Community Investment Note and targeted it to the areas that they felt aligned most closely with their mission. And they learned through that a lot of good lessons internally. One, how to bring it up to their board for approval, where the hot buttons were with their board. How to push it through their finance team or their investment team in a way that they got comfortable with it. And now, about 5 years later, they've moved off of working through us directly, and they're doing direct PRIs to groups that they, you know, really feel like are boom square in their mission. And that's kind of how they got over the bridge, and they got both their board and their investment team comfortable with this opportunity. Yes?
Sorry, I have another question that relates back to that Kellogg example, because I realized that I had an assumption in my mind that I think you're telling me is not accurate. Does the legal organizational structure of the entity receiving the investment matter at all in terms of whether it's defined as a PRI or an MRI?
No. So we have another example of a private foundation giving below market terms to create small business in their community. And if they're establishing that the relationship between that and their mission, that's fine. They can invest in businesses.
Now, where it does come in play is if you're doing equity. So if you're doing impact investing, and impact investing is a term that goes across all different types of capital structures, loans, mezzanine debt, equity. If you want to make equity investments in an organization, they need to be a for-profit organization that can hold equity and provide returns to a shareholder, if that's what your expectation is, rather than a nonprofit that can make a profit but has to funnel those profits back into the organization. So if you want to make an equity investment, that's where the advent of B Corp, that's where the advent of some of the hybrid social structures have come into play to kind of take in that type of investment in a way that's both returning impact, social environment, and financial return to the investor.
But just, again, to clarify my question, I think I heard it. I can make an equity investment in a private company that's a for-profit company and define it as a PRI.
And define it as a PRI if it's creating social return. That's the trick there. And below market. But it's hard to know what market is too, right? I know that's what you're saying. You're like, what's market? And that's very hard in the debt markets today. It's almost like comical, right? Is it a negative return? So that is very subjective. It's very, very subjective.
That's where the attorneys and the
I was about to say, and this is where the attorneys and the lawyers come in. And this is where you know, honestly, also another vehicle comes into play. He was back here earlier, but Tim Freundlich, who runs Impact Assets, and what he runs is a donor advised fund, where you make a contribution up front to a donor advised fund, which is a recognized structure by the IRS. And over time, you grant it out to various organizations. And what makes his program very unique is while the assets are sitting, they're invested with Impact. And so I have worked with people, family foundations, where the IRS kind of in this gray area of what is market and market adjusted returns become so unsettling for them that they have elected to go through a donor advised fund. Yes?
How scrupulously does the IRS look at whether the mission of the organization to which you want to make the PRI is aligned with your own mission? As long as that mission is a traditionally nonprofit mission and is it's more of a Venn diagram and there's some overlap of mission, but is that more an internal
right
issue that the board has to go through themselves?
So the question is the mission test that the IRS would look at to assess is this a PRI? How much of an overlap do you need to have between the organization you're interested in investing in and your own mission? And would you have a very clear answer? I have mine from experience, but you might have more of the definitional.
Mm. you may want to answer from your experience, and we also may want to call on someone who's prepared for this, I think, who is doing both market rate mission investing
sure.
and PRIs. And
bring out the smoking gun.
We have a smoking gun in the room if he's still willing to to
I'll
participate. We would love it. And this is Vic DeLuca from the Jesse Smith Noyes Foundation, who is a 201 speaker. So this is a preview for you for tomorrow. And we're so happy to have a foundation practitioner with
well,
us.
Well, yeah, we have not done PRIs in a while. So we're really focused on the market rate. So I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer your question. But we've done, let me back up. The Jesse Smith Noyes Foundation, we are now about $45 million. And back in the 90s, we were at $60 million. And we decided that we wanted to rethink how we did our business. And what we decided was that we wanted to focus on 100% of our assets to pursue our mission. Because, you know, IRS says you have to do, I don't know if you dealt with this already, but IRS says you have to, you know, spend 5% of your assets a year on making grants, and the other 95% they say nothing about. So we said, well, we want to talk about 100% of our grants, our assets, and align it to our mission. So what we did is we made some PRIs at that time. That's okay. But we also started doing some market rate investments. And we even went as far as setting up our own venture capital fund and invested in, our home run was Stonyfield Farms. We invested in Stonyfield Farms years ago and got a terrific return. It was a market rate investment. We fund on the grant side sustainable agriculture and food systems, and so this was a perfect way to marry our financial investments with our grant making. I was told there's a couple of foundations here who have done impact investing. I think that what I always like to say to folks is do this at the level that you're most comfortable with. Start small if you have to. We kind of took a huge leap. I would never suggest anybody do that. By the way, looking back, our venture capital fund was a bust because it's just high stakes, and we were not prepared for it. But we learned a lot about it, and we did other investments in sustainable forestry, and which had good return, and some that weren't all that good. But the important thing is to find harmony between your investments, your market rate investments. I think a lot of people here probably, if I ask the question, maybe I will, I would assume most of the folks here are either board or program staff, executive directors, and there's few that are dealing with the finances of your foundation, is that correct? Okay, so if I asked you if you knew what you owned, who would be able to tell me or raise their hand that you know as a foundation person what you own? Okay, it's pretty good. But imagine if you were a foundation that was focused on working in a city somewhere and doing community development and human development, social development, and your investments were going out and you found out right now the hot button is your investments were invested in gun companies that were making assault weapons or high ammunition magazines. Those would be things I think you would want to avoid. So what I always urge people to do is to know what you own so that you're prepared to make choices so that you can avoid, certainly there's things you can avoid, but there's also things that you can pursue. And I think that's the whole notion of impact investing, is that are there things that you can pursue? Now, obviously, in that example, you're not going to invest in building a better gun, but there may be things that you can do. You can make choices if you're doing community development. You can invest in things like Home Depot and Lowe's, where you can actually then become, as a shareholder, you can become engaged with them to talk about things that might pursue what you're doing on the grant-making side. So I think PRIs are a very important tool, but don't forget the market rate returns and your ability as a shareholder, as an owner of a company, to play in that arena. I think it's important for us as owners of corporate America to let the corporations know what we think. And you can do that through a lot of low-level stuff, through proxy voting and signing some letters, and you can go ratchet it up to doing shareholder resolutions and being very active. But it's important, I think, to go back. I would urge you, if there's a takeaway that I would leave you with, is to go back and just sit down with your finance people and say, what do we own? And what are we investing in? And how does that match what we're doing in our grant making? And we have, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. We've had our ups and downs like every other foundation. I think our 2012, at least our preliminary return, is about 13%. So we're do this. We feel we're competitive. Both on, you know, we're still investing. We just did a major investment in a Rose housing development. It was actually his office building development fund. It's a green business development fund. So he's taking buildings and turning them into green LEED certified buildings. We just did another investment recently in Sustainable Jobs Fund, where these are market returns. So this is a group that's creating jobs in green industries and other industries for underserved communities. So there's ways in which you can pursue your mission and you can have an impact on doing some of this investment. But I think it really starts with knowing what you own and then developing that strategy from there.
Close up. It was lovely to hear all the rich discussion. We have a few minutes left. So before, because it was such rich discussion at each table, could we just go around to each table and one person just self-select themselves to kind of report back, or, you know, whoever wants to, on one kind of aha from your conversation? It can be an opportunity, it can be a challenge, or just a comment about, you know, the discussion you had that might be beneficial for all to kind of hear. We'll start up here at the first table. Not you.
we thought one of the challenges was following the impact. Make sure that the impact stays positive for the life of the loan.
Yep, that's a great one. So carry that one through. This could be good to grill the guys in 201 about how to carry the impact of the loan through. Okay. Yep.
So we had Mel joining us, which is really helpful, but I think one of the things that we touched on was who really pays for due diligence, who pays for the actual contractual work that's going to be done, and who's going to pay for the lawyer, which I don't think we're entirely sure as to what's supposed to happen, but we had an interesting conversation about it.
So, and this is another great question to bring to 201. They're going to get down deeper into the actual investments and these types of good questions. Over here? Okay.
So at least most of the people at the table, I think, weren't paying attention to what the questions were. So we kind of went off on various tangents. The only real question we had about the case was how 6% was defined as below market rate in the current environment. But then we had a lot of discussion about, you know, some of the reasons we might or might not consider PRIs or MRIs in our organizations, and what some of the barriers were, you know, capacity barriers or, you know, an opportunity that's too big for a particular entity to take on. You know, got into some of the examples from the Noyce Foundation of how they're approaching things.
Great, behind you. That great. So another great thought. Did you two work together independently? Yeah. So both together. Great.
Well, yeah, I can just say one thing we talked about was the case mentioned that the 250 was more than they would usually grant, in a conversation about how much larger should you be willing to do a PRI versus what you grant, and what are the limits to how much larger that would be?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. When you think about doing this work, you're taking on a different type of risk. And so how to assess that risk, evaluate that risk, because it is a question that you'll go through with your board and your investment committee, et cetera. So a good one for 201 as well. Yes?
from our standpoint, we actually read this, but most of it was actually just in general on the ideas of the loans. And I'm fortunate here that I've been one of the few that actually has done some of these. And actually, it's really trusting the people you're working with, because rather than collateral, it's just the trust you're getting to on that area. And on the interest rates and everything, I mean, at 6%, it's not. You would have to do it below the prime rate, which is 3.25 right now. So you'd be at that instead.
Okay. And so there's a whole piece here too that's being brought up about structure. So how do you structure your investment? There's a lot of elements to it. Why perhaps working through you rather than a bank, which was, you know, part of the discussion I think we all touched on when we saw the 6%, still might be a real great relationship for that nonprofit to have with you. It can be flexibility of the term and the rate, the lack of collateral. Maybe it's the, you know, you're not going to do heavy paperwork. You'll write a promissory note rather than have 20-page legal agreements. There's a lot around that investment, around the structure, that is a great 201, 301 question. Over here.
Last table.
And you picked up on what we talked about.
Okay, I do. Yeah, see, I worked with this table, so I knew I was coming here. It was around structure and whatnot. Well, it is a couple minutes after 6. I know 6:30 is the party across the street, so we look forward to seeing you there. Is there any other closing remarks?
Please remember to complete your evaluations, either on paper or on the app.
Yeah, so complete your evaluations, yes.
Is there something you'd prefer us to, where we could read something in 2 or 3 pages about what you tried to tell us today so we get ready for 201 or 301, if I still feel...
Unsure. You bet. So, Mel, do you want to give some resources? Yeah, we had a handout, so we'll make sure that reaches everyone. There's some over here. And in general, we put a lot of thoughts on the table. Feel free to come to either of us to talk more. Thank you.